So this week, Lena Carroll and I talked to Sarah Rudebeck and Birken Sesson about Recallify, their AI-driven memory aid, which is developed for both clinical populations and for all of us. So welcome to the Neuro Clinic. It's been a while, hasn't it? Lena and I were just discussing how we probably the least prepared we've ever been for a Neuro Clinic, but we're graced with the presence of Birken Sesson and Sarah Rudebeck. Welcome, both of you.
Hello.
Hello, good to be here.
Lena, do you want to say hello? People have probably forgotten what your voice sounds like.
Yeah, those Irish tones have been forgotten to people. I'm Lena Carroll and co-host of the NeuroClinic podcast with Ingram.
So Birken, Sarah, welcome. We obviously, as we usually do, we've kind of got a little bit of an idea about where the conversation might go. And I think you've consented, signed the form and all that. So we had some questions to ask you about, well, I guess this conversation's about the app that you've recently developed, which we were just talking about how it's possible to get the names wrong and mispronounce them despite your best efforts to make sure that couldn't happen. But the app's called Recallify, isn't it? And it was called Reminder, is that right?
It was called Reminder then. When we tried to register it in certain places, app stores, etc., we realized it was too generic and the name was already taken. So we've
already got Reminder apps, so you had to find a distinctive name. So
yeah, exactly.
You've settled on Recallify. So this is a, what would you describe it as? How would you describe the app? Actually, what we should do, this is me being rusty, we should allow you to introduce yourselves. Sarah, yeah. do you want to go first?
So my name's Dr. Sarah Rudebeck. I'm a clinical psychologist. I specialise in paediatric neuropsychology, and I currently work at King's Hospital in paediatric neuro rehab. I also work a tiny bit in private practice, and I've been developing this app as well with Birken in my spare time.
And my name is Dr. Birken Sesson. I am a former academic in AI. Then I had a 10-11 year stint in the city working in finance, and towards the end of 2023 I decided I wanted to go back to doing AI full time, and since then I've been looking at different projects, and what the main one of the projects is this one.
That's great.
So I'm absolutely fascinated, Birken. I think you're probably our most exotic guest that we've had on the podcast so far, which is fantastic. And yeah, I guess I'm really keen to delve in and ask more.
So we would normally start by asking how people got into neuropsychology, Birken, but the question for you obviously is, how did you get out of finance?
It was tricky in that, it's a good kind of living, and sometimes it might be a bit difficult to break the habit. I guess what I really find, what I thought was the main motivator was the recent advancements in AI, that really is my life's passion, and I decided I want to just join the cohort, stay and ride the wave and see where it takes us,
like joining the revolution of AI at the moment.
Yeah,
or the evolution maybe.
Sarah, you are a neuropsychologist, so we can ask you the conventional question, which is, how did you first get into neuropsychology?
I did a PhD in cognitive neuroscience at Oxford, where I met Birken, and then I moved into clinical practice after that, and I did my training at Royal Holloway. And I guess I've always been really passionate about being in neuropsychology, just because, I did a PhD. I'm very fascinated by the brain and itself and research. But I really wanted to work with people. And so really neuropsychology combines both that you know, passionate about the brain and how it works with clinical practice and helping people day to day. So for me, it was a really kind of perfect fit in terms of career, although it is quite a long career trajectory that it can take quite a bit of time. So no, I've really, after clinical training, I went straight back to pediatric neuropsychology, and I've stayed there ever since for the last kind of 9-10 years.
I'm sure many of our listeners will appreciate that long journey and that idea of it being a long, long journey. It's certainly something that we've heard from other guests, isn't it, in the past? And it's not a quick journey to pediatric neuropsychology.
I'm going to steal your joke, Sarah, which is that this is your third child, right?
Yes, exactly. So me and Bertram have already got two lovely children, and this qualifies as our third child and partnership. And I guess that's really where the idea for the app came from, was my clinical practice and working with patients day to day. But then I knew what AI could do in my conversations with Birkin at home and what he was working on. So I'm in quite a privileged position to get to talk to an AI specialist day to day. And so that was really where the idea came from, was surely we could be doing more for people with acquired brain injuries that I see in the clinic using AI to help them in their day-to-day lives. So that was really kind of where the idea came from. It was a kind of perfect storm of my clinical work and then my kind of knowledge about AI from Birkin.
And it wasn't the case, presumably, that you were looking for a reason to work together. This just happened because obviously you're in proximity to each other. There was an area of common ground, an obvious scope for development.
I think Sarah inadvertently headhunted me.
Do you think this had always been the aim, right? Is that right?
It was a long game, yeah. but you know, I was also aware Birkin was really wanting to use AI for good. And, you know, I think this was something perfect to kind of work on
together. Yeah, my academic work has been in lung cancer and, you know, it's in AI and specifically clinical decision support. During my time in finance, I kept on doing some projects for the NHS as, you know, as an honorary researcher as well. So, you know, that's kind of what I really like doing, build stuff using AI. And, you know, that hopefully helps people.
I suppose one of the questions that I have in mind, I just want to get this out of the way, is how long did it take to get to this point? You know, from those early conversations to where you are today, and we'll talk about where you are today and what the app looks like in a minute, but just give us an idea about how long it took.
I think we first started discussing this kind of mid-April. Right. And then from then on, I built a very basic prototype in a couple of weeks, but right. Then, you know, just expanding it to what it is at the moment. It's the app has been available on both iOS and Android for open testing. So anyone can download and use and, you know, give feedback on it. That obviously requires, you know, a lot more work to make it more robust and, you know, scalable. That took another probably 2-3 months.
So what give us an idea. I mean, what does the app look like? What would we see if we had it in front of us? We can give people links, can't we, to demo versions and the website?
Yeah, and great. Things like people wanted to download us and give us feedback. So we're in what's called beta testing phase of the app. So it's really a prototype. And like we said, me and Birkin have kind of built this together. He's the one that's built it with kind of input from me and my patients in the clinic and inspiration from them as well, and feedback from them. So the app is really simple to use. So it records or, you know, you can now put videos or audio in as well, conversations, meetings, lessons, whatever you want to remember in the future, you can upload into the app or you can record it in real time. And then using artificial intelligence, the app will transcribe very accurately what is said in whatever you've uploaded. And then it summarizes it into 5 bullet points for you to look back over in the future if people need to kind of refresh their memory, for example. And then it also has, you can, so you've got all your memories on a timeline and you click into it and then it shows you a nice summary. And then you can actually ask the app, like recall or retrieve your memories by asking questions like, what was I told to do on this day, or, you know, anything about what's happened in the past. And it will search through your memories and tell you the answer based on the memories that you've got in there. And finally, it has a learning section where you're asked multiple choice questions about specific about a memory, and you can like train a little bit and kind of test yourself based on what happened. I guess that was really thinking about maybe more like students and other people who want to kind of enhance their learning a little bit. So those are the four main functionalities currently in the app. But like I said, we're in this very kind of prototype development stage, so it's likely to kind of change and move on. Basically, though, we were kind of trying to go with the encoding consolidation.
And I was going to ask about how much of this borrows from a, I suppose, a neuropsychological process, and how much of it is meant to be a rather separate infrastructure.
No, I mean, it was, you know, AI is really just it's using kind of what we know about the human brain, isn't it? The way that AI has been developed. So it is just using what we already know about memory functioning. And so it really, we designed the app around, you know, episodic memory, basically, and how researchers think it works. And yeah, that's how it's developed and designed at the moment.
I suppose when I'm asked, here we are on a Tuesday, often when I'm asked on a Monday, how was your weekend, right? It's always a challenge because I'm at work and I can't quite remember the fun that I was having at the weekend. I'm thinking about the audience. I'm thinking about the little bits I can remember and whether it's okay to talk about all of that kind of stuff. So I guess there's quite a complex social process, isn't there, that we might engage in? And as you say, if students were using this to try and recall material from a lesson, that's a very different process to maybe talking about a party that you've been to. Do you think AI and the app kind of help equally on all of those kinds of fronts, or do you think it's sort of there's a specific niche where it's designed to be most helpful?
I think so where we are at the moment, you know, Sarah mentioned that this is being beta tested. We have around 160 users. The functionality is quite broad, and I think the way this is going to evolve, and you know, the answer to would AI help in these different contexts is, you know, we'll see. The AI engine itself is very much general purpose, but I think what we will see is, as you know, we progress on this journey, the user experience elements may need to be adapted to, you know, specific population needs. Our priority, as Sarah mentioned, is acquired brain injury. And recently we've also been talking to some people about mild cognitive impairment, you know, the potential of this being used for mild cognitive impairment populations.
Yeah, so I guess it's really going to depend on user feedback and, you know, continued development of what we realise this app is most useful for, and we'll have to kind of wait and see a little bit.
And I guess it really makes me think about that kind of, like, I guess the overlap and the mirroring between AI, computer science and neuropsychology. Like, it's all about complex systems, isn't it? And what happens kind of if a bug crops into the system, and how we adapt and how we change our system. So thinking about the nuances and kind of the social context that Ingram's talking about, it's going to develop over time, isn't it? You know, like, kind of if we ask ChatGPT to do something for us, it'll generate kind of what's out there in terms of what the answer is to the problem. But the more that's out there, the more that it can kind of self-correct almost, I guess, in a way, she says very naively about AI and how AI works.
Yeah, potentially. But I guess there's also a kind of acceptability around using technology. And there's a big difference between recording a lesson or a lecture and using a phone to help you and like summarize it for you than recording a conversation with a loved one. And that, I guess, is what we need to kind of work out and see what people think. And if they do think that would be something they want to do, or if they feel like that's their kind of personal memories and things like that. So I think it's really, we've got to, our plan is to next do a lot more kind of acceptability and feasibility with acquired brain injury users and their carers, and kind of continue to find out how people want to use it.
I guess it makes me think about, you know, those videos that you see sometimes online of like kind of Generation X versus the Millennial versus Generation Alpha, isn't it? Of, you know, how acceptable and usable is this, and that kind of interface with different populations as well. You know, if I think about, you know, my parents and how they might access AI, there's a big difference between both of them, to be fair. And, you know, I think about kind of myself or my siblings, and then think about kind of younger people in the family. It's very different in terms of how they even pick up technology and use technology, the symbols they use. You know, I think about, you know, me going out at university, we hardly ever took any photographs, like where I see people now out at university, and it's, you know, all about the phone and what, you know, phones can capture. And I guess that, you know, how much people use technology and have this as part of their lives has entirely changed in a really quick space of time. At least it feels like it was long, like not that long ago since I was at university. It is, but
yeah, absolutely. And it was the teenagers I worked with that inspired this app, particularly ones with like very severe memory problems whose lives were kind of changed forever. But, you know, in reality, as clinical psychologists, we know that a young person is at the beginning of their journey, aren't they, of a brain injury. And so often it's kind of too early to start adapting and using these tools. And you know, there's a kind of psychological grief almost to go through. So sometimes, you know, I think I was inspired by teenagers, but I also wonder if some of them will find it actually quite hard to take up this kind of technology, and they might come to it much more as an adult. Do you see what I mean? To manage their cognitive difficulties going forward.
I suppose I had a question. This is sort of a slight departure from the sort of technical interface and how acceptable that might be. But there's something about, I mean, I really enjoy the fact that my iPhone reminds me what I was doing a year ago, or gives me thematic, what do you call them? Like picture shows sort of things. But it's very much driving a memory that I have, which is reasonably healthy, right? So it's reminding me of things that I remember. The application to individuals who have very poor memory is an extra step, isn't it? Because this would form a sort of synthetic memory for those individuals, right? And I suppose one argument, like anything that's synthetic, it might not feel like a real memory. It might feel like something that's been fed to me through a particular filter that's not, doesn't have the kind of emotional resonance that my real recollections do have. And that's not a challenge to the app, right? But it's something about how it might feel to those end users. I wonder what your thoughts are about that synthetic kind of quality to it.
Yeah, I mean, nothing can replace your actual lived experience, can it? And AI can't. But, you know, the app will enable people to listen back to the conversation. So you can listen to it as well, like the real thing that happened. And it just then transcribes everything on them. So, you know, they can, there is that element to it. And then I think in the future, what we were thinking about is actually integrating into more visual cues and kind of context and pictures and things like that.
So, yeah, but one of the things actually, as someone, you know, from outside the domain, we spoke with our friends in the neuropsychology kind of domain quite a bit as we were discussing what the app should have. And my understanding is the way the hippocampus kind of operates really is in a way contextual, and it helps adding metadata to the content, such as visual cues or location or
time,
etc. So these all exist to hopefully already in the app, to hopefully, you know, help assist with that retrieval process.
So I suppose there's a kind of chance that that experience of recalling something is not entirely synthetic, but actually what you're doing is you're using the app to bolster the level of activation to such an extent that you have a genuine sense of mentally traveling back and remembering something entirely novel.
Yeah, and that's the hope, is that can help consolidation of memories and rehearsal. You know, and people say to me, a patient recently said to me, I know I need to watch something 5 times to remember it, because she's watched Stranger Things 5 times and she can remember it, you know. And this is really, she can't remember her lessons because they happened once. So this is just an ability to, like, let's try and give people the ability to do that in their day-to-day lives. You can't just have people only able to remember Netflix when actually they need to be able to do their GCSEs as well. So it's just trying to kind of create that ability in their day-to-day.
And I guess that really, it really brings in what I call, I'm sure other people call it as well, amygdala memory, like that emotional memory that goes along with things, isn't it? Which, you know, I think, Berkan, that's what you're getting at. And I'm absolutely loving how you're becoming a neuropsychologist through this process, Berkan, and recognizing the functions of different parts of the brain is lovely to hear.
I very recently finished reading 2 books. One is Why We Remember. The other is How We Learn.
Exactly.
Really, really good books too.
The main worry for me is that Berkan revolutionises neuropsychology practice and becomes a more famous neuropsychologist than me.
And the rest of us become extinct.
I know,
and
the rest of
That's presumably when the partnership comes to an end, right?
Potentially, yeah.
So I suppose we talked a little bit about what the app looks like, and obviously you'd invite people to have a go, dive in. Download the beta version, give you some feedback, which is what you really want and need at this point, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We'd love people to show it to their patients if they'd like to, and just give us as much feedback as possible.
And then presumably there will be a subsequent development phase based on that.
Yeah, so next we're going to be moving on to kind of more formal user testing with some PPI groups also attached. We're talking to CBIT and Headway about setting that all up at the moment. We've got Andrew Bateman involved to kind of guide us a little bit in app development in neurorehabilitation. And then on from that would be obviously more formal research, acceptability, feasibility, and randomized control trials. Particularly, we need to kind of check from a more scientific perspective if the app is what it's doing to memory, and, you know, if it's improving people's memories or reactivating the hippocampus and that kind of thing. But that would be a bit further down the line once we know.
Or quality of life. I think that's an equally valid outcome measure.
Yeah, and kind of mental health and enabling people to be more independent in their day-to-day lives. So, yeah, there's a long way to go and a long road ahead of us in terms of research and development.
And I guess it really strikes me, as you all know, I'm in this like slight like transition zone from having, you know, qualified as an adult neuropsychologist to also now qualifying, hopefully, as a paediatric neuropsychologist. But it really strikes me, I think one of the things that has really kind of stood out to me in working in pediatrics is this, like you've touched on it, Sarah, like you've got your whole life ahead of you after having a childhood brain injury. And it feels really, really key to get those strategies in early so that you learn them, so that you can finish your GCSEs, you know, get your A-levels, get into college courses, you know, become successful at work. Where I think, you know, because of, and this is my perception, other people may have different views, but because of a massive lack of like cognitive rehabilitation for young people, I think things like this like kind of are still so important, aren't they? Because it's kind of almost plugging that gap of the lack of cognitive rehabilitation that's provided through statutory services in the UK. I'm going to get on my soapbox about that now again. I'll like get off my soapbox again about the lack of cog rehab in pediatrics. But it feels really, really important then that we tap into all of the resources that we possibly can that have a far reach for these kids to, you know, have a successful outcome, to have good mental health, to not be behind at school, to have that quality of life, as you say, Berkan, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm I'm always someone who wants to kind of try and use research to benefit people. And I was a bit shocked when I went into neuropsychology of the lack of up-to-date research in neuropsychology sometimes, and that some of our tests are quite old potentially. And so, you know, one of my research projects on my PhD was doing memory training to try and support people's memories and see if we could get any kind of transfer effects. And I think sometimes these things don't work and they fail, like all the memory training, you know, didn't seem to really help people's memories apart from the tests that you were training them on. But we've got to try and use research to inform clinical practice and to benefit people. Otherwise, really, it's just a kind of blue skies, isn't it? So I've been really passionate about trying to kind of bring research straight into clinical practice much quicker than I think it necessarily is at the moment.
And I guess you've talked so far about the clear application that we would recognise around rehabilitation and the utility of this app with individuals who've got memory problems, but presumably it also has a wider market for individuals who might just want to use it as a everyday memory aid, who've got perfectly adequate memory function, but it functions very well to supplement that, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and we mentioned earlier, the current functionality is quite broad. You know, this probably has more bells and whistles than might be necessary in some settings, but that's mainly because we're still trying to find, you know, the correct product market fit. Our intended population is those with neurodiversity, but, you know, it might happen that this goes somewhere else, or maybe, you know, bifurcate, or, you know, have different flavors for different audiences.
And I guess, I mean, your background, Berkan, is in finance. One of the kind of questions about, I suppose I had about you, or we had about you getting into this kind of space, is that this is a partnership. There are two of you, right? You bring different things to the table. But how much of this is a business, something that you need to deliver a return on your investment, whether it's time or finance? Do you see what I mean? I suppose there are these kinds of questions about your orientation. Is it about, we'll build the app that's going to be useful, it's based on some neuropsychological principles, we'll kind of see where it goes, but we're open-minded, or I'm driven to create a tool which has a particular application in this particular market, and I'm going to design with that narrow framework in mind? I suppose I'm just wondering where, not necessarily where you see it going, because we'll talk about that, but what is this, a business? Is it a hobby? Is it a side hustle? I think the phrase that's probably more than that now, isn't it? Because it's become a full time job, is it?
Yeah, based on the time I have been spending on this for the past 3-4 months, it's definitely more than a side hustle. Because, you know, it's not just the technical side of it. There's a lot of obviously administrative. Mm-hmm. Workload here as well. In terms of where it goes, I think we're basically taking a bit of a wait and see approach.
So we're applying for grants at the moment to support our kind of patient activities and seeing, you know, like I said, doing user testing with ABI, getting charities involved, PPI groups. This all kind of costs money. So we're applying for some. You know, NAHR grants at the moment to try and support that. And if we do anything in mild cognitive impairment, that would be quite similar, actually, applying for grants. There's quite a lot of funding streams for MCI, so that's great.
Yeah, so it is a bit, I would say, slightly vague in terms of where this is going, what is this, but it is very clear on what this is not. This is not like, make money and become rich project. This is a project that at its heart really has the best of intentions to hopefully help people who may not have ready access to technologies that might potentially make life a bit easier for them.
Yeah.
So somebody said to me yesterday that something wasn't my responsibility. Somebody that was unwell, and I kind of offered to go. Somebody I don't really know, but it really made me think yesterday about that sense of, where do we get this value about being pro-social and about helping others? And I think that's, that really feels like that's in the mix here, is that value for both of you about, the greater good, isn't it? And kind of, serving our community and supporting others. I wondered if you had thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is mainly to try and help people, and because we're going through kind of grants, and really, the point if those are successful, is for it to go back and to be used in the NHS. That's the whole point of NIHR grants. So very clearly, my career has all been about helping people, and that's what we're really trying to do here, is to get AI to help people, and for it to not be seen as this kind of frightening thing, and actually to harness the power of it, and it to be really beneficial for patients. So that's certainly where our motivation comes from.
And I guess the reason, the values that Cleena's talking about, that you kind of want to keep at the heart of what it is that you do, and it gives you a sort of grounding point, doesn't it, in terms of informing next steps. It was a genuinely open question. I mean, I guess you could have set out with the intention of, we want to scale this up as a business. We want to think about the extent of the markets, the diversity of potential markets for these kinds of tools. We would like to see it as a phone-based app that everybody uses, right? Because I could certainly see some value in this. I've used some of the tools. I think we talked in an earlier conversation, Sarah, about a tool called SenseCam, which would take pictures every sort of 3 seconds or something, and I remember wearing one for a day. But it was quite a mind-blowing experience watching back that video, which is essentially a series of still images taken at 3 second intervals, and how it assists with that process of recalling the day. So, if I did wear one of these for a weekend, it would be much easier to answer that question on the Monday morning. What did you do at the weekend? So I suspect that there will be challenges ahead in terms of markets opening up that perhaps weren't in your original sort of set of intentions that might present themselves to you. And I guess you've got to either say, well, we could do that, but we're choosing not to because it's not really where we want to be headed. And I guess the bigger a thing gets, the harder it is to stop that happening.
Well, and it's also mine and Birkin's time and capacity
Yeah.
to look at different markets. I guess, yeah, we have thought about potentially, students using this, or potentially people with ADHD and things like that. Or, like you say, just general users with dyslexia and other things like that. Like, I have dyslexia.
And I mean, even with the focus primarily on ABI, and then, potentially MCI, mild cognitive impairment. On the ABI side, we're looking at 1.3 million people just in the UK. And let's make the assumption that 10% of them would actually be a good fit to use something like this. It's still 130,000 people. On the MCI side, you're looking at 400 million people globally. One of the actually good things about this app is, and it currently is available in even in its open testing version, is that it is multilingual. You can go, you can select Spanish, and then you can use the app in Spanish. All functionalities in Spanish, or whatever language you prefer. So I think the market is there, without having to lose our focus too much, and still, hone in on the neurodiverse population.
There's also something quite important, isn't there, about an app that's built with a clear focus in mind, because there are clearly lots of apps there that are there to remind me I've got an appointment. It's called a calendar, and there are apps that will take notes for me and do various things, but they're not designed for this particular purpose. And there's something quite special, I think, isn't there, about defining your market and designing something that explicitly addresses that, rather than saying, why don't we just pick something off the shelf from the app store and see if we can translate it into an ABI context, because that often feels rather clunky.
Yeah, and we know from our clinical work that working with someone with ABI, it's such a diverse field in itself, isn't it? Those kind of really mild conditions up to very severe, profound kind of learning needs. So, you know, we're talking about a very kind of heterogeneous group of people anyway, when we even are being specific about acquired brain injury. So I think, like you say, we've got to kind of focus in and really try and create the app around their needs first and then kind of go from there.
And I guess that really made me think about, you know, a lot of times, like, people will go onto different websites and stuff and look at kind of, you know, what are the cognitive difficulties, what are kind of the strategies I can use for them. And there's lots of books, we all have them on our bookshelves behind us, with kind of the techniques and strategies we can use for different cognitive domains. But this really makes me think about something that's, it almost goes back to that idea of a rehabilitation prescription in a way, of like, what is it that's going to help you, and kind of, you know, the fundamentals around kind of cognitive rehabilitation. What are the things that you used before? Like, kind of, what are the things that, you know, your peers are using? What are the things that you find useful and acceptable, rather than kind of just a one size fits all for everybody, isn't it? I guess it's back to kind of what you were talking about, of like, kind of this, there's a giant market out here, but this is going to work for kind of probably a large proportion of that market, but maybe not working for everybody as well, and needing to kind of think about how it might be adapted or how other things might fit in to kind of coincide to make it work, like kind of like having a reminder on your phone that tells you to record and to use your Recallify app, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's what we need to develop more with user testing, is like use of notifications and reminders, and make sure we're not annoying people, basically. But, you know, we need to kind of work out how that works, I think.
Yeah, well, one thing I'm very excited about from more a geeky perspective, and also just dipping my toe in the domain, is my understanding from the limited reading I did is that the testing effect is as close as you get to a free lunch as, you know, possible in the neuropsychology domain. It's very well established from my understanding. And that's something that, you know, I'm quite interested in seeing how it works in real life and how it may potentially help people.
I guess it made me think as well about, this is one of those moments where there's a thought in my mind and I can't remember the exact name of it, but I know Anna Adlam has worked on this project, hasn't she? It's like a rehab strategy for young kids. Sarah Ingram, help me. Does it start with a T, maybe?
It's the TOPS, is it?
That's it. It's the TOPS. But I know part of that includes kind of family members, doesn't it, as well? And kind of in including families kind of within those strategies as well. And I guess, yeah, I was kind of curious about how that might work with this app as well, of kind of who are your prompters? Do you become your own self-prompter? Is it kind of family members that prompt you, or kind of teachers or assistants at school?
Yeah,
I've just Googled TOPS just to make sure that we're not going to have to retake that to put the actual name of the intervention in there. But rest assured, Cleaner, we got it right.
It is
excellent. Sorry.
Yeah, I think we will have to see more in our kind of accessibility and feasibility bit of this project going forward, about how, you know, family members and teachers and other people involved might have to be part of the use of the app, or maybe even have the app themselves. Do you see what I mean? And kind of interface with it. So I think that's kind of something we'll have to really think carefully with users and their family members about, because it's quite an obvious thing, isn't it? But at the same time, you know, teenagers and young adults might not really want that kind of, you know, they're trying to draw away, aren't they, from parents? So we'll just have to see how it goes, I think, in that phase.
So I understand that in terms of where you see this going, you see the focus of attention at this stage, and you started what in April, you said, Birkin, that it's still very much early days, and I guess the focus is understandably on learning about how this app could be used. It doesn't sound like you're intending to flood the App Store or the Android Store, whatever it's called, with various apps doing various different jobs, but to perhaps remain focused on memory for a while and gather some evidence about what works in this space, rather than spread yourself more thinly. Is that the case?
Well, my understanding, I think in its current form, it also touches on kind of organization, some, you know, is that right, Sarah? Like executive function, boosting, etc. In addition to obviously, like as the name implies, recall. And yeah, these targeted to hopefully help people with neurodiversities.
But we're not planning an attention version and an executive function version and things like that. But you know, it could develop, couldn't it? Like if AI can do so much, so the functionality could be that you've got your memories and then that's sending out prompts for what was in your memories to you to remind you to do things and plan and organize yourself better. So like it's all connected, isn't it? The brain and its cognitive functions. So we'll have to wait and see how it goes. But yeah, no, we're not planning to spin out and flood any app stores at the moment.
And that, I mean, that sounds to me very sensible. It must be hard, I guess we've touched on a couple of times, to sort of have that kind of clarity of focus when potentially there are so many different things, particularly if you can, as you did, Birkin, turn an idea into a proof of concept in a matter of a small number. Obviously the hard work remains ahead of you as well as some of it behind you, but you're saying actually a lot of the work for you is in making this work, right, rather than necessarily jumping off to start and do something else.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're pretty set on our focus, you know, of the neurodiverse population and the ABI, and then potentially MCI.
And I suppose that, again, similar question, but these things can kind of grow quite quickly. You've only got so much time. There are two of you. You've got now three children to look after. Two of them, if you'll allow me to say, are probably more important than this one in your lives. And how are you going to keep the balance in terms of priorities? Because not always easy. This might sound like a bit of a personal question, but not always easy to work with someone that you live with, have children with.
Yeah, I mean, it is a balance. And I guess I don't work full time in the NHS is the honest answer. So I am using some of my own time to do this. And otherwise, I wouldn't personally have the capacity to be doing this. And then, you know, to be able to do something like this, both of us need to have that kind of designated time. Any parent needs it, don't they? To actually work on something. So that's what we actually have managed to carve out in this instance. But like you say, it's kind of going to be managing to do that going forward, which we're certainly planning to do. But, you know, it is a juggle doing a project with your own husband, mainly around, you know, childcare needs, let's be honest, like, and having to do things on days where you don't have childcare and kind of managing that, because we're taken up together.
Your question reminded me of on grand designs, you sometimes watch couples who embark on a 7-year build project, and at the end of it all gets a bit too much.
At the end of it, there's only one of them living in the house. Someone has had to find somewhere else to live, right?
Let's hope you avoid that outcome.
It's been wonderful talking to both of you. We didn't even ask the questions about whether AI could take over my heating controls inadvertently, but that there is always that kind of spectre in the background. I suppose it is worth saying, is there anything to be feared from this app?
I mean, this app is, I think, quite a tamed and good use of AI in that, you know, what the app can record and what permissions you give it are very strictly regulated and controlled by Google and iOS on, you know, whatever platform. The stuff that I personally, even as an AI specialist, find a bit suspect these days is the variants which are ever, you know, continuously recording. I think they call them pendants. I don't know if I would, you know, use one of those or, you know, endorse one of them. I think it's better to, you know, constrain what's being recorded, when, etc.
I'm glad I asked the question, because I guess it's a kind of a concern that would, even if it wasn't made explicit for some people, would be there in the background in terms of, am I all of a sudden going to get flooded with adverts for things that I talked about in my chemistry lesson with a pal, right? So you're saying it won't do that?
No, it can't. It cannot, by design, it cannot listen in, because it's not the operating system. You would need operating system level access, so you need to be Apple or Google to be able to do that.
And all the data going to the cloud is encrypted as well. So even when it's on the cloud, it can't be telling Google Ads what to push to you or anything like that. So it's encrypted what you record as well.
So a reassuring note on which to end for anyone who was worried about what happens to the data. But I'd urge everyone to have a go on it and to send you the feedback. And we wish you all the best with your endeavor going forwards. Thank you. Thank you for this conversation.
Good luck.